This is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams. 30 years ago this weekend, the President of the United States quit his job and flew home to California. Richard Nixon, under stress of the long investigation into Watergate, under threat of an impeachment conviction, made a speech to the nation August 8th, and with his family, left the White House the next morning. Here is how NPR covered that event in 1974.
And now President Nixon emerges from the White House to walk the 50 yards or so from the White House to the waiting helicopter. Mrs. Nixon is on his arm. With them also is the man who will soon be the 38th President of the United States, Gerald Ford, and Mrs. Ford. They are walking past the press corps now, smiling. Mr. Nixon walking deliberately.
Again, this is the 9th of August, 1974, tape recording of NPR's coverage. Richard Nixon leaving the White House. In the studio with us now to eavesdrop on this bit of history is one of the key players in the Watergate saga, John Dean, who served as counsel to President Nixon. Welcome, Mr. Dean.
Nice to be with you.
President Nixon's resignation speech was the day before his departure on this morning, the next morning. Many people recall that address from the East Room, but for many, the true iconic moment was the next morning when Mr. Nixon walked out to the helicopter and he waved. He turned to the crowd and waved. And for that, we'll go back to this archival tape.
Mr. Nixon, without a backward glance, mounts the three or four steps. Now he turns around, waves, a big gesture, his big double-fisted victory gesture. Tricia and Edward Cox enter the helicopter after him. And the President of the United States is now inside the helicopter.
John Dean, I'm sure this is a moment that still cycles through your memory from time to time. Richard M. Nixon was the first president to resign. Your testimony before a Senate committee had a great deal to do with that. What is it like to hear that tape and think about that day, the speech before and the day of the departure?
I guess the first reaction is how quickly 30 years can go by.
Right, for sure.
It really is a quick 30 years. I think that obviously there are a lot of mixed feelings. There were more good days than bad days for me at the White House. I have fond memories, and when I became the target of Mr. Nixon's effort to keep his office by scapegoating me, obviously we were in a battle, but I understood what he was doing. It was political, and he had to do it. He just picked the wrong guy.
Did you think he was going to resign or be impeached?
I really thought he would fight, and I thought he had very good and respectable arguments that he could have made to fight an impeachment, to go to trial in the Senate, and he might well have, you never know in the Senate what might have happened.
Let's go back a few years earlier. The Watergate break-in was June 72. That fall, Nixon wins a landslide victory against the Democrat George McGovern. Big win, big celebration in the White House. What was the status of the cover-up at that time, and did it contrast in sort of the dynamic inside the White House with the sort of the thrill of that victory in November?
Well, there was no thrill to that victory. In fact, it was the dark cloud of Watergate that was hanging over the White House because everyone who focused on it knew we had a serious problem. You know, you mentioned the break-in and then the cover-up. What's been long misunderstood is it wasn't the bungled burglary that was being covered up as much as the fact of what these people had done who were involved in that bungled burglary while they had worked at the Nixon White House before they'd gone over to bungle the burglary. They had bungled other burglaries. And this was what was most troubling and the reason that they had the leverage they did. Otherwise, I think that the committee to reelect would have been cut loose. All of the people involved would have been cut loose, and it would have just ended right at the get-go.
In June of 1973, you talked to the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, the Urban Committee, accusing the president of involvement and breaking the law in the cover-up. 4 days of testimony. Am I right in remembering that your wife, Maureen, was right behind you on the television view?
You're correct. She was.
Yes.
And surprised that the camera was paying so much attention to her. She hadn't gone there with the expectation of being the focus of anything other than just to be there with me.
Had elegantly long blonde hair. Right?
It was actually in a tight bun.
Pulled back, yes. Yes. Well, anyway, at the end of that 4 days, the terms high crimes and misdemeanors suddenly was real. Later, you were found guilty of conspiracy to obstruct justice.
I pleaded.
Pleaded guilty, sorry. Any doubts ever about what you did, about the testimony?
No. You know, I really had a sort of a naive belief when I broke rank that by doing so, I'd force Nixon to come forward, and it would actually protect everybody in the presidency. Those of us who'd made mistakes would pay for them and get on with it. All it did was compound the problem for Nixon. He just elevated the level of his cover-up.
Here's a part of Mr. Nixon's resignation speech the day before the departure that I'd like to play for you now.
I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation.
Would you have advised Mr. Nixon differently about that speech? I know you probably really wanted to have written part of it.
Well, I'll tell you, when he wrote his memoirs, he took a similar stance that indeed he had really done no wrong. And he took that position to his grave, if you will, saying that when a president does it, it makes it legal. There is a legal argument that can be made. It's a shame in a sense that that wasn't litigated, because it's left only more clouds over the presidency as to what indeed is proper and improper presidential conduct. And if the Congress had focused on it, I think they probably would have made some judgments. I don't think they would have tolerated what he thought was proper activity, and it would have defined the limits that would affect us today in what's happening with the current president and the current presidency.
Mm-hmm. When you came to the White House, you were 31 years old, Georgetown Law graduate. You'd worked for a while for House Committee. Somebody hearing this interview now who is 31 and perhaps a little bit idealistic, perhaps has been watching West Wing, could say, well, you know, power, as somebody said once famously, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Is it worth it? Can you still go into a White House job and stay idealistic?
I think they can, and I think I know a lot who have. Not everybody who went into the Nixon White House became tarnished as a result of it. So it's not necessarily a tarnishing experience. I said when we started, I have more fond memories than bad memories. Great experience. You can't see power any closer than being on the White House staff, and you realize both the strengths and the weaknesses of the system, and you realize what makes a good and bad president very quickly after being there.
John Dean, former White House counsel, retired investment banker, author of several books, including most recently Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you.